This is the Motion Martial Arts Podcast. On today's episode, we react to UFC 246, Conor McGregor versus Donald Cowboy Cerrone. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, how are you guys? So today we're going to kind of do something different. We're going to kind of react to UFC 246, which was last night, Conor McGregor versus Donald Cowboy Cerrone, and we're going to kind of focus really on two matches, but we're going to discuss a third match more because we want to kind of discuss this idea of kind of what happens when you were on the top and now you're kind of on your way down, which is, yeah. I think, something that maybe some people that are competitive or have competitive aspirations in martial arts can relate to. So yeah, let's first start by talking about a match from last night, which was, hopefully we don't butcher the names, but it was Macy Barber versus Roxanne Modafferi, which was kind of the classic grappler versus striker match, and was also kind of the new upstart taking on the veteran.
Yeah.
So for those of you that don't know, I mean, I could be wrong with these dates and what I'm saying, but I believe that Roxanne Modafferi started fighting in MMA back in 2003. So she's like 17 years into a MMA career. Again, I could be wrong with that. But I know that she's at least been, I was even said last night that Macy Barber was like, she had her first match when I was 5 years old. Wow. So it's definitely a huge gap in experience. And Roxanne Modafferi is not known for having good striking. And those of you who watched the last match last night saw that. And again, I'm the non-striker, but Dan, you saw it. The striking didn't look great from her end. But
no.
It looked like in the first round she was getting some of the better of those exchanges a little bit.
It certainly didn't look like Macy Barber was being particularly dominant with the striking.
Yeah.
It looked, you know, I mean, looked like neither one of them was very dominant on the feet. But it looked like a good back and forth that they kind of had.
Yeah, so, I mean, my kind of understanding it was that this was kind of... Macy Barber's the up-and-coming new female star for the UFC. They're pushing her. There was this narrative that she wants to be the youngest champion in the history of MMA. She wants to beat Jon Jones' record, which is a narrative they've been pushing for a while. And last night was her step up to taking on a savvy veteran, get another showcase win. I think that that's what they thought. They were like, hey, we're going to set this up, have another highlight reel knockout, be able to push her again, and then be able to push her towards the title shot. And again, those of you who have watched the fight, and those of you that are going to maybe go out now and watch the fight, you're going to see that the plan failed.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You can definitely see that in the UFC, what people that they pick, that they're going to promote a lot, that they kind of identify as the stars, the people that are going to come up. I thought Paige VanZant was a similar one with that, you know, she was one that, you know, you kind of saw a lot of early on in her career, that she was going, that she was identified as being kind of star fighter material, but didn't really
have
pan
the talent.
Out.
Yeah, she doesn't didn't have really the fighting talent, which is, it was her and Sage Northcutt, and they were going to push them both. They were like,
absolutely.
Two good-looking kids that they were like, okay, and they're athletic, they're good-looking, they're well-spoken, these are going to be the people we push, but they just didn't have the skill level to kind of back that up.
Yeah, in some ways, too. Sage Northcutt is somebody who I remember, you know, when he was around a lot, he was young, he was like 19, kind of getting thrown into the UFC with that. And it's a little bit like,
I
think the business practice sometimes, it's like kind of identify that, that's a fighter that's going to sell. So they push that kid maybe a little bit too quickly into this high level.
Well, that's kind of what they did with Macy Barber. So getting back to kind of the Macy Barber narrative, I believe Macy Barber is 20 or 21. We can find out in a second. Let me look it up. Yeah, so she's 21 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So again, same sort of thing. I think that they saw this as somebody who's putting together highlight reel knockout. She's young. She's marketable. So they kind of were like, let's put her in against somebody who's a veteran, who has somewhat of a name. So the diehards are going to see it. And they're going to see, oh, she's beating somebody who's legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
She's taking on somebody who they know has a grappling edge. So it shows that, hey, she's not going to be exploited by grapplers. And again, it just didn't work out. So kind of giving a little bit of a, what I think we saw is the match opened up and Macy Barber wasn't getting the best of the striking. And Roxanne Modafferi got an upper body clinch, drug the fight down to the ground. And those of you that are grapplers, it looked like to me that the focus for Macy Barber was just to try and tie her up and hope for a referee stand-up.
Yeah, just trying to survive it.
Yeah, and you saw that there was a huge skill gap in the ground. Now, the question then after the first round was, hey, can she get her down again?
Yeah.
So I think that I remember watching it last night, and then you and I rewatched it, so I've watched that match two times now. I was like, okay, so first round it went her way, but I don't know if she can get her down because the takedown wasn't particularly great. Again, you could see, though, in that first round that there was a huge skill gap in the grappling. And then sadly in the second round, there was an injury to Barber's knee.
Yeah.
Which kind of changed the dynamics, but once again...
It looked weird, too, because it wasn't... The injury didn't occur when they were on the ground before, but it was when she was on her feet. She got hit with a punch.
Yeah.
It looked like her leg kind of buckled, like she stepped back and the knee rolled.
Yeah, and there's an immediate reaction. She yells and grabs her knee and then continues to react to... Obviously, the fight's going to continue, which is a whole nother conversation that we should have at some point, which is the whole fight or flight response.
Sure.
And how to sort of train your way so that you can kind of make that a positive thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the flinch response and stuff like that. But again, that's another conversation.
Sure.
Yeah. And then it hit the ground again. And again, I saw a huge disparity in the grappling skill level. And Modafferi started opening her up with some strikes, opened up a bad cut on her head, and again, just went to town. Not a lot of striking from Modafferi, and not really, honestly, a lot of submission attempts, but again, just positionally dominating her.
Yeah.
And well, I just...
To me, she was definitely going for the ground and pound over the submissions.
Yeah, a little bit. I personally didn't even feel like she was really going for ground and pound. I kind of felt like she was maybe trying to get a reaction off the strikes for a submission attempt, because the strikes, it never looked like she really opened up.
Yeah.
She never really postured up and started raining down even when she got from the mount. It's kind of the classic, an organization is trying to build somebody up, and because it's the fight game, the plan kind of doesn't always work out. And who knows what's going to happen from here, because...
I mean, it has to be frustrating for some of the fighters involved in the organization, too, that, you know, I don't think anybody would really argue that the UFC, I mean, they don't operate, you know, as you'd expect, you know, most, strictly athletic organizations to. That, you know, it's not like that if you may climb up to the rankings that you'll get the title shot that you should. Yeah. Often they'll give it to whatever fight they think will sell. It has to be frustrating if you chose to invest so much of your life in this sport and you're the kind of person that isn't identified as like star material, so you don't get pushed for.
So this is kind of, you know, this is kind of the reality is that it's an entertainment business.
Yep, of course. So they make money.
Like this is not the NFL.
Sure.
Where it's like the team with the best record advances to a playoff, and then from the playoff, whoever wins an elimination game, as you go through the elimination games, becomes the world champion.
Yeah.
That's not what happens in MMA. That's not what happens in boxing. That's just not what happens in combat sports.
Yeah.
There have been a couple organizations that have tried that. Yeah. So Pride, when Pride was an organization, they tried to do the tournament thing. But even within that, the tournaments were separate from the actual titles lots of times. So it would be like the tournament champion, and then they would have the title holders.
Yeah.
And then Bellator used to do... tournaments constantly, and they've gotten back to that a little bit because they kind of went away from it. And then you have the Professional Fighters League, who does a tournament, which is the closest thing that you see to that sort of approach.
Yeah.
And with like the Professional Fighters League, if they do like a season, you have different point tiers based off how you finish the fight and how you win. And then you go into an elimination round.
Yeah.
And then the winner from the elimination round wins $1 million.
Hmm.
So, but that's kind of considered the B League.
Yeah.
So like that, that's the thing is that, and even Bellator, which is highly successful, is kind of considered the B League.
Yeah.
And I mean, personally, when Pride was around, I was much more into Pride than I was into the UFC.
Yeah.
I just thought that Pride production was through the roof.
And the same people doing one now?
There might be involved. One guy who's involved, yeah. That was involved, possibly. But, I was always more of a Pride fan person. I really liked the Pride. Pride had, in my opinion, just like, at the time, they had Anderson Silva, Vanderlei Silva, Dan Henderson, Fedor Emelianenko. Nogueras.
Yeah.
They just had all these guys, and at the time...
I just refer to it as kind of like the golden age.
Yes,
era.
Sakuraba.
Yep.
So like... And the approach just seemed a little bit different, but again, even that was kind of considered the B-League. The UFC is the big show.
Sure.
And that's just the reality.
Top fighters in the UFC are making far more money than any other MMA fighters.
So there's some controversy about that, and it's hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look actually at the disclosed payouts from the UFC, they aren't necessarily that much more than some of these other
Even
shows.
For like the very, very top guys?
So the very, very top guys definitely are. But some of the lower guys aren't making more than they make in some of these other organizations.
Oh, yeah.
But you can't have sponsorship.
Yeah.
And this is a huge controversial sort of topic. And I kind of don't want to go too much into that because I think we should talk more a little bit more about wrapping up just kind of this Basie Barber thing. Which all this stuff is obviously connected. But
so you're more familiar with her record than I am. Would you say this was kind of one of the first,
very
experienced grapplers that she fought?
I think so. I mean, honestly, at this point, I'm kind of... what would be considered a kind of a casual MMA fan in that I don't care that much anymore. I'm not going out of my way to watch every UFC event. I kind of pick and choose the people that I like and I'm excited for.
But you would say what you saw of her on the ground, it kind of seems like, you know, that she was way out of her element.
She looked like she was outclassed on the ground. It looked like she just didn't have the positional awareness and was just kind of hoping to latch onto somebody and get a stand up.
Sure.
And kind of maybe I think was kind of believing that, you know, I won't get taken down. Now, this could be the best thing that happens to her because now she kind of got the loss out of the way.
Yeah.
And she can build, this isn't boxing, where if you have that one loss, you're done.
You're done, yeah.
Because boxing wants to have this, like, aura of invincibility, you know?
Yeah.
Got
to be 50-0 or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much, you know? Yeah. So, it definitely could be a good thing. But again, this is an example of, there's these plans for these fighters and then things don't work out. And like, you know, it's kind of something that makes it cool and exciting. But at the same time, like, it's not like they're going to give Roxanne Modafferi a title shot or even try and put her in the running for a title shot. And Macy Barber can go out and win her next match and probably be involved in the possibility of getting a title shot.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the way the system works.
And it's one of those things that's like, you understand why it's that way, because it's how they make money, you know, they're trying to make the most entertaining fights that's going to get the most number of people watching. But at the same time, it's like, you can't help but, I don't know, it bothers me a little bit, you know?
it kind of eliminates the thing that makes it a competitive sport. It's almost not a competitive sport.
Sure.
Because like you aren't going to get rewarded for winning necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you know, there's definitely the competitive sport like aspect to it, but then there's also that UFC, or, I'm sorry, that entertainment aspect of it that, you know, they're making matches and trying to put on a show for you.
So, going into sort of another match, but really I want to more discuss like this kind of topic of what do you do when you have been at the top and now you're on your way down.
Yeah.
And that brings us to Anthony Pettis.
Yeah.
Which I don't really want to talk too much about the fight. I more want to talk about the fact that Anthony Pettis was the top guy in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and he was a world champion in the WEC and the UFC.
Yeah.
He beat some of the top guys, and now he's kind of at a crossroads. And
he's had a lot of losses lately.
Yeah, and he's beaten some good guys, too.
Sure. And had a really good fight with Ferguson.
Yeah, and if you kind of look at who he's taking on, he's pretty much always taking on the top guys in the world.
If I remember correctly, when he fought Tony Ferguson, which would have been sometime last year.
It's sometime in the last 2 years for sure.
Yeah, but I think he rocked him early on. Like, he was dominant in the beginning of that fight.
So, in the second round, I believe it's in the second round, he hit him with a good punch, knocked him down, and was on top, rained down some strikes, but he broke his hand in that round.
Yeah.
And then his coach called it and was like, I'm not sending you back out there for the third round if you can't throw a punch.
Yeah.
And they just threw the towel in between rounds. But, like, this is something that I feel like everybody can relate to.
Yeah.
And this comes from, like, more of a martial arts perspective. It's like, none of us are getting any younger.
Yeah.
And what do you do when all of a sudden you're maybe not the top dog anymore? And that could be from a competitive standpoint, top dog in the world, top dog in your region, top dog at your gym even.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, it's some people have different reactions to that.
Yeah. To keep it a little bit just strictly the professional fighter type things is also how these people make a living.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's, I think, a tough position to be in. There's actually... Have you ever read any Jack London before? The Call of the Wild, White Fang?
I have not, actually.
And stuff. So he's an author who I like a lot of. But he also was a very big boxing fan in his day, like early 1900s. And he had a great short story called A Piece of Steak. And it was about an Australian boxer. Just to give you a short premise of the story, is he, at the beginning of it, he's an older, you know, like, boxer, this guy who's past his prime and on his way down, like we're talking about, and he's got a match coming up with a young up-and-comer.
Yeah.
And like the beginning of the story is he's trying to get his butcher to give him a steak, you know, so that he gets some good food in his stomach for this match.
Yeah.
And, with the idea of being like, I'll pay you when I win the match, you know, I'll be able to pay you, no problem. And the guy doesn't give it to him, and he ends up going and doing the fight, and it's a great short story. You know, it gives you like, it tells you like narratively, you know, you're going through the whole fight like that, and he narrowly loses. And it's this sad story that, if I remember correctly, to paraphrase it, you know, he said that like the young up and comer he was fighting for like glory. You know, it's like he's still at that time in his life when, sure, he's making money too, and it's his job, but it's that he's enjoying just like the process of struggling and overcoming and achieving like that, where this old guy who's been in the sport a while is on his way down. It's like, he's fighting for the money. Like he needs that money to feed his children like that. And it's one of the story, a very sad story. At the end, you know, he of course loses the fight. I think that the story kind of ends with him just like weeping in the ring at the time.
Anthony Pettis has, assuming he made the right decisions, he's definitely made enough money in his career where he can live off of his probably fight earnings if he, again, assuming he made the right decisions.
Oh, yeah.
Who knows the answer to that? But it gets overlooked how many times somebody fights for 15, 20 years professionally and are kind of just an okay fighter who never make that big payday.
Yeah.
And it's like, what do you do next? You've kind of sacrificed your health and your body in hopes that you would have maybe a big payday at some point, and then where do you go next? And that's why you see guys hanging on for too many fights.
Pettis is from a more recent generation, I'd say, when there's been more money in the sport. I think that I've definitely read about, specifically Frank Shamrock. Is there like guys that were real pioneers early on in the sport?
Yeah, so I think Frank Shamrock is good. I think he's financially good. I would maybe more go, and again, some of these names, guys, you can... I assume that a bunch of you maybe do know some of the names we're talking about, but some of you probably don't know some of these names.
Yeah.
You can Google all these guys and they'll come up real quick, you know. Yeah. You'll find them. All these people have Wikipedia pages.
My impression was that early on in the UFC, though, with MMA in general, even the top guys weren't making very good money, but still taking the same risks and everything like that.
Yeah, so I think the initial wave, I think it was pretty popular, and they were making decent money. Some of them were, at least. And Frank Sharamok also fought a bunch overseas where I think there was good money. He fought in Japan a bunch.
Yeah.
I think he invested right, and he opened up a gym and had all these things. So I think he's a good example of somebody who actually is fine. Mark Coleman, who's an old school guy, who was a high level wrestler. He might have even wrestled for the Olympics at some point. He was super high level. Like, he's broke.
Yeah.
There's been a bunch of stuff. Like, he needed a hip surgery, hip replacement surgery. Like, you know, like, it's like, and he fought in Japan too. I don't know what happened to his money. Mark Kerr, who's another name. These are like old school guys. Mark Kerr was an ADCC champion, high level American wrestler, early old school MMA guy. He definitely made some money. There's like a documentary on him called The Smashing Machine that you guys can watch.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like, again, a guy who has no money. He's like, works as a car salesman. So it's like, he did all these things to his body.
Yeah.
Destroyed himself, and then still has to go out and try and work a normal job later on in life.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to talk about those situations and tell those stories.
Sure.
Everybody just wants to tell the story of the, you know, the person who, the Anderson Silvas of the world.
Yep. That literally, you know, that top,
George St.
that Pierre's. Top 1% of fighters in the world, that, you know, it's something that's really financially, you know, stable, kind of like, you know, life to live. If you're in that top 1%, you know, you'll make enough money if you're smart with it that you can be financially secure. But for everybody else, it's a huge risk that you're essentially taking. I guess they kind of got to decide, you know, when they're going to stop.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I mean, like, the thing is that there's so many different reasons why these guys may be fighting, you know. Who knows what the motivation is?
Sure.
Sometimes it is financial. Sometimes this is just like, this is something they need to do.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, this is something I need to do. I can't explain it. I need to go out there. I need to,
yeah,
you know, be in these wars, these battles. This is just something I have to do.
Yeah. That's what I like so much about the Jack London short story about it. It was because it kind of illustrated those difference in mindsets that, you know, young up and comer, it's like, for him, he's achieving something, and yeah, financial too, but then the old guy on his way down, it's like, literally, he just needs this win because he needs the money.
Yeah.
To do it.
I mean, like, the guy that Anthony Pettis took on last night is a guy who has a great record. I think he was 15-2. He's a long-time Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He was like a Legacy FC, which is another MMA organization. He was a champion there. He had a couple losses from when he had stepped up and taken on some better guys in the past, but he was ascending. He had just gone through, like, I think he had won 5 fights in a row against some really, really good quality people.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like Anthony Pettis kind of didn't really have a lot to gain from taking this match, but he still did it.
Yeah.
Which to me shows that Anthony Pettis still has something that's driving him, because
sure,
he probably doesn't need the money.
Yeah.
So there's some other factor that, who knows, maybe he thinks he can win another title, which maybe he can.
Yeah.
He's only 32 years old, which it feels like he's been around forever, but
yeah,
he really he's young. Like, people forget that Randy Couture really didn't make his run until he was really in his 40s.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of, who knows where it's going to go next, you know?
Sure.
Let's take a quick break, and then let's come back and talk a little bit about Cowboy versus McGregor.
Sounds good. On to the main event.
Yeah, so I feel like this kind of conversation about Pettis ties in really well with Cowboy.
Yep.
So Cowboy is definitely a guy who has been around for a good chunk of time. He's probably a guy who's, I don't know when he had his first match, but it's probably in the early 2000s.
Isn't he tied for most fights in the UFC?
I think he has a ton of records. I think he has most fights.
He definitely has most wins. He
most
has
finishes, yeah, most wins, like most, probably most ring time, a bunch, yeah, of different things. But
I think that he's tied with somebody else for the most total fights.
So he's one of those the guys who is always been like in the top 10, but has never won the big fight.
Yep.
Would pretty much be willing to take on anybody in between 150 to 170 pounds at any time.
He's a fighter I've been a fan of for a while. I like Cowboy a lot, but it seems like whenever... There's been a couple of times when he's got, like, a very big fight, and it's kind of one where, like, if he got that win, it would open a lot of doors for him. It seems like he falls short.
Yeah, I mean, he's the sort of guy who, like, honestly, it seems like he's probably in the gym training today.
Yeah.
that's just, I mean, he's taken so many fights on short notice. He just loves it.
Yeah.
I think he's one of those guys that would do it even if they weren't paying him money, he would be in there.
Yeah.
But I mean, he is obviously a massively popular fighter, but not nearly as popular as Conor McGregor. Mm-hmm. And I am not a Conor McGregor fan, but Conor McGregor is massively he's the most popular, most famous MMA fighter probably ever.
I've always been a fan of his as a fighter, specifically. I mean, I like, especially when he first kind of was getting big, and he has had, like, one kind of, he was just getting one win after another, you know, one knockout after another, a lot of them in the first round. So I definitely like watching him fight. I think he's an interesting, especially from a striker's perspective, he's a really, really interesting fighter to watch. You know the way it does, but I'll never be as that big of a fan of his just simply because of the person he seems to be outside of fighting. But I think it's important to be able to separate those things to a certain extent. You know, it's like as just straight up as an athlete, as a fighter, you know, I like Conor McGregor a lot. As a person, it's a lot of things about him that really rub me the wrong way.
Yeah, I mean... The question has always been, again, how much of it is legitimate and how much of it is fake, but it seems like in recent years, more of it has been legitimate. There's been more of him getting into silly, stupid...
Yeah, punching old men in bars and smashing people's phones.
Sexual assault cases.
Yeah, so they got...
But he came out for this match, all the pre-fight stuff, he was... being respectful.
Said he was sober too.
Yeah, so there was something different about him.
Yeah, he said in some interview that he was drinking even like the fight week with Khabib.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, maybe might have some real issues with alcohol, which would explain a lot, I guess. But,
I mean, so talking about, I guess, more of the actual fight, I don't know, leading up to the fight, it seemed like something was just different with Cowboy.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it's, he's just, you know, to a certain extent, he can hang in there with the best guys in the world, but he's kind of on his way down. Like, it's highly unlikely he's ever going to get another title shot.
Yeah.
Highly unlikely he's ever going to be able to beat the top tier guys.
Yeah, this is his third loss in a row, and he was on like a 4-fight win streak before that.
Yeah, and his last two fights, he had he got knocked out by Justin Gaethje, and then the fight before that was the Tony Ferguson fight where he broke his nose and he blew his nose, and then the eye swelled shut, and the doctor stopped it. Yeah, I mean,
so tough losses, you know what I mean? Like, those are two really good fights.
Yeah, and then he just followed it up last night by getting knocked out in 40 seconds.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I don't know. Again, there's lots of things. All this stuff is documented. You can find it. He had his first kid. His son is probably about a year and a half old now.
Yeah.
You know, that's a life-altering experience. He's definitely up there in years now. He's in his late 30s.
Yeah.
Again, he's had the most UFC fights. He's been in there probably more than anybody. He's been in so many wars. It seemed like he was almost more comfortable with losing going into the match.
Yes, yeah. I would say that some of the pre-fight kind of media stuff and like... I feel like he almost seemed too cordial with a lot of the stuff that a lot of the interactions he was having with McGregor and stuff like that. That was definitely a little bit of the impression that I got. I didn't get a lot of confident. Like, he didn't seem particularly confident in everything leading up to the fight. And then saw the way the fight played out with it too. It's just like was...
It was very reminiscent of Conor McGregor versus Aldo in the sense that it was pretty much...
Yeah.
I think it was the first strike landed, same thing, right? Yep. And once that first strike landed, it was pretty much like, okay,
yep,
this is probably going to be over. With Aldo, it was over.
Sure.
Right? Yep. So they like, I think it was like he threw with Aldo one punch and that didn't connect, and they threw the left and it knocked him out cold.
Sure.
This time was a head kick, which is something that you said you were kind of shocked by.
Definitely, yeah. So somebody, you know, it's a little bit from my background that kicking is what, as a martial artist, what I'm best at, and McGregor is of course a, you know, phenomenal athlete, and you kind of would see, you know, it's not that he wouldn't kick in his fights, he would, but you know, it never seemed like a particularly effective part of his skill set.
Yeah,
is that he would use it, you know, to some things, but it was usually kind of just to set up what he was really good at, which is his boxing, you know, more than anything else. But I gotta say that head kick was beautifully set up. That was a beautiful kick. Like that, you know, he was standing kind of right outside of that range. He kind of had like a wide guard with his hands up high. When he turned the hip, it really looked like he was going for the left, which is, you know, kind of his main weapon. And I saw kind of a breakdown of it where they showed you everything in slow motion with it too. And it's just, it was exactly what he was going for. That,
yeah.
Cowboy reacted as if it was the left hand coming. So, you know, he reached out with his own, I think from the stance that he was in, it's like, so he kind of put his left hand forward, and he was no longer able to block the kick that was coming behind it. Instead of the left hand, it was the left foot. And they talk about that with a lot of differences between like kickboxing and MMAs. In kickboxing, you have those big gloves.
Yeah.
And can use them to absorb a lot of the impact. So the hand position with the way that you're going to defend against a head kick is very different in MMA, because you really want, if it's a big heavy kick coming at your head, you really want to have both arms there to defend against it if you're going to block or something like that. Whereas with, you know, if you're wearing big gloves kickboxing wise, I think you can defend against the kick with one arm a lot better often in kickboxing. So he just put him in that kind of the perfect position for that head, yeah, and it landed, you know, beautifully. The foot was right on, not only the head, it was on the jaw, and that was really what ended the fight, was that head.
Yeah,
kick.
Yeah, everything that happened after that.
There's also some weird stuff before that with them in a clinch and with the shoulder bumps.
Yeah.
Which is like something you don't really see that much. You know, coming from like traditional martial arts background, it's something you actually see in karate guys do a lot, the close range kind of striking that I practice, that like the shoulder bumps, and you use them often to kind of create space and set up other strikes, but something you almost never see in MMA. And to tell you the truth, I personally kind of thought of it as something that might be effective for like self-defense, as in, you know, like kind of low level fighting, but you don't see that in the UFC because those guys are so high level that something like a shoulder bump isn't going to really be that effective. But McGregor gave me, you know, kind of cause to think that might not be the case now, that the shoulder bumps can be a very effective techniques.
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely interesting, and it's sort of like, it's one of those things where it's like, you see it and you're like, oh, why haven't other people done this before?
Yeah,
it's sort of the same thing with those kicks that John Jones does to the knee.
Yeah, the oblique kicks.
Yeah, where you're like, why don't more guys use this? Because or it's like it prevents, so with the oblique kicks, it prevents the guy from wanting to step in,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
So it changes their desire to step in and get into striking range.
Yep.
And then
he's got the body, John Jones got that reach for it too. And he's really good with stuff like that, long legs, long arms.
Yeah, and then with the shoulder bump thing, it's like, well, if you start adding those sort of shoulders in, that can very much change the clinch game.
Absolutely.
And it can be a deterrent for a fighter who likes to be in the clinch. So lots of wrestlers who want to do the dirty boxing thing,
Yeah.
That can be a little bit of a deterrent if you tie them up and you start throwing the shoulders. Because, and same thing, if you like the dirty boxing, throwing that shoulder can be something that's an interesting technique to kind of throw in there as well. But yeah, it's kind of like, why don't you see it more? Like, there's a shoulder lock that is taught in jiu-jitsu. It's like self-defense 101 when somebody pretty much grabs you around your shoulder. John Jones has used that at least on one occasion, maybe two occasions.
I've said, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And he's gone for it. I'm like, why don't more people use that same technique?
Yeah.
Because it's there a lot off the over-under clinch. And I understand you might, like, you miss it, you end up kind of in an area where your back, both of you, were into striking range, but it's easy to disengage and get out.
I think I know exactly what you're talking about. It's one where you're kind of in a clinch position, he brings the arm under, and he's pretty much taking the...
Yeah, so it's an over-under clinch. So people who don't know grappling, an over-under clinch would be what is considered one overhook and one underhook. So an underhook is an arm underneath the armpit, and an overhook is when pretty much somebody has an arm over your armpit, you re-trap it. So each person more or less has an underhook, and that's considered an over-under, but they have underhooks on the opposite side. And as a response to the underhook, to prevent the person from getting double underhooks, which is both arms underneath the armpit, which is the dominant position standing.
Yeah.
And from a grappling sense, you end up in an over-under clinch. So from that over-under clinch, the underhook, so the underhooking arm, your opponent underhooks you, you can overhook it, step to the side, and catch right above, right above the elbow and kind of turn into... It's more or less a standing Americana, more or less.
Sure. It causes the elbow to go in at a bad angle.
So what's called an Americana or a double wrist lock for grapplers, which is it's a fancy way of calling something a shoulder lock.
Yeah.
Again, you don't see it very often, but it's something that's there. So those shoulder bumps, again, it's something that maybe we'll see it more now, maybe we won't.
Yeah. It's kind of funny when you even, and it's another a little bit off topic, and probably not something we want to get into right now too deeply, but if you want to call MMA, you know, because MMA is definitely a sport, you know, like a competitive format for fighting. Yeah. But, you know, there also are some things that you can call MMA a style. That there are certain things that there's a culture around MMA that creates certain techniques that are things that MMA fighters do. And there are certain things that they don't. And it's always, like, you have this tendency always to think, because it's like the highest levels of fighting is what I think of as the UFC, that it's like, well, if it's not done there, then it probably isn't that effective. You know, and yet you see innovation still. You know, there's still people that are always, that are gonna, they're gonna, the game is still changing, even at the highest levels, it always is. So I just found it interesting, because I'm not entirely unfamiliar with shoulder bumps, but I always never really thought about that as something that you would see at that level of fighting.
I mean... Again, who knows if or when we'll see it again? That's kind of the question. I mean, and the thing is also going back to these two guys as far as like their fight careers, they're in very different stages of the game.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I honestly don't people who are fans of Cowboy. I don't know how many times realistically we're gonna be lucky enough to see him fight.
Yeah. No. Definitely.
Totally. Yeah, I mean, it's very reminiscent of the Chuck Liddell thing.
Yeah.
Which is like, there was a point where Chuck Liddell kept on getting finished in spectacular, brutal fashion, and Dana White had to step in and say, hey, you can't fight anymore here, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I gotta protect you against yourself. And I think we're closing in on that with Cowboy.
Yeah.
And now Conor McGregor seems to be on the opposite end of it, where he's feels like he's kind of rededicated himself for one more big run, possibly.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, he's pretty young too. I think McGregor's like only like a year older than me. I think he's like 30 or something. Like
I think he might be a couple years older. He might, yeah. but he's, again, that it's hard to tell. So he, like, I think he might be 31, but I think Cowboy's what, 37, 38?
Yeah.
In that 7 years of difference in age, well, Cowboy has like more than twice the amount of fights.
Sure. Yeah.
So like the thing is that McGregor has honestly, for somebody who's done MMA professionally as long as he has, doesn't have a ton of fights.
Yeah.
He I don't think he's ever been knocked out. So he hasn't taken any sort of damage like that.
Yeah.
Like, the thing is that there's the kind of tear on his body is not the same as some of these other guys.
Sure.
So he did have a significant ACL injury.
Mm-hmm.
But besides that, I mean, he's relatively healthy. He's kind of not really fought much the last now 3 years.
Yeah.
More or less. So to me, it seems like he's gearing up for another big run, and mm-hmm. he's who knows where it's going to be at?
Because he's definitely a very different type of fighter. Like, McGregor is not the fight anyone anywhere type of fighter.
Yeah.
At all. You know, he's kind of, he picks his fights carefully. That's why. And what he, in the post fight conference, it seems like what he's pushing for is the Diaz trilogy fight.
Yeah.
Which is one worth talking about. Although we're talking about veteran versus, not that McGregor, you know, wasn't experienced at that time too. But I think I remember Nate Diaz, and it was probably the post fight conference after he beat McGregor the first time, where he said something like he has more losses in the UFC than McGregor has fights.
Yeah.
And it's like a difference in experience with it is an interesting one. That, you know, to what extent, because you could think like, and personally, I was rooting for Cowboy a lot in this fight. I was pretty disappointed, not only that he lost, but that he lost in such a clear, you know, like, it wasn't even, I mean, he just got dominated for 40 seconds. It was just, I was hoping at least we'd get to see, you know, a really good fight between the two of them. I kind of suspected that he wasn't going to get the win against McGregor, yeah. But I certainly would have been very happy if he had. I thought that would be, I think a lot of people too, you know, kind of make some extra money and then also see just Cowboy get that, you know, big win, especially considering how many fights he probably has left realistically. I think it would have been something that would have been a big, you know, part of his legacy and his career.
Yeah, well, I think so this fight had been rumored for years, and I think it was deliberate. The timing of it was deliberate.
Yeah.
Again, McGregor doesn't do anything without careful thought. And the reality is, so I think Conor McGregor is one of the most unlikable guys to ever fight professionally.
Yeah.
I think that, and again, there's tons of people that love him because there's people that love that kind of call your shot
mm-hmm.
and then make it happen sort of thing, which he's great at doing.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't like anything really about him, to be perfectly honest. But again, sure. I understand that he's an insanely talented fighter.
Yeah, the only thing, what I like about McGregor is just what he does.
Insanely
talented. And what he does in the ring. That's pretty yeah. much where it ends for me.
I think it was, to me, I think it was very thought out who he was going to take on. But I also think that there's tons of people that think, because they don't like him, that he isn't hardworking and isn't good, which is sure. not the truth. And there's only really, I think, a handful of guys that match up really well with him. So
yeah.
one guy's Khabib. I don't see a pathway for him to beat Khabib.
Nope.
I think Justin Gaethje could potentially be really bad for him.
Sure.
Gaethje is one of the best pure wrestlers in MMA, even though he doesn't use it very often.
Yeah, it was but striking.
He's just going to come up.
He's a power puncher.
Yeah, he's going to right off the bat, he's going to throw a power leg kick, which might get him caught with a strike to the face.
Yeah.
But he's super durable, super tough. He's hard to put away.
Yeah, I could see that fight very much going his way.
So I think that's a guy who's a tough matchup. Yeah. Diaz presents problems for him.
Yeah.
But the reason why Diaz presents problems for him is because Diaz has great ground stuff.
Yeah.
And he also is just a guy who can take so much damage.
Damage. And he's also got a significant reach advantage on
him,
too.
And great cardio. And great cardio.
It's like where McGregor's the knockout artist. He's like the sniper that's just trying to catch that knockout, the left hand. Diaz is the volume puncher, where he'll just wear you down.
The thing is that if you look at striking credentials, technically Aldo and Cowboy both are, if on paper, should have had striking advantages, and they both got put to sleep. Well, they both, Aldo and Cowboy, had on paper they were better strikers than McGregor at the time they faced them. When you look at the big picture, and they both got put away very quickly.
Yeah,
When he took on Chad Mendes, Chad Mendes was supposed to be the grappler who had this huge advantage.
Yeah.
Chad Mendes.
Before Habib, I think that Mendes is the best wrestler.
Oh yeah, he was by a significant amount, and everybody was like, "So this will be the end." And
yeah,
he again, it was a short notice fight, but I mean, it is what it is. Nobody made it wasn't first of all it wasn't McGregor's fault that Aldo got hurt.
Yeah,
and if Mendes wanted a full camp, he could have declined the fight, and somebody else could have been given the title shot.
Sure,
you know. It's kind of on you, and if as a professional fighter, if you're choosing not to stay in shape year round, shame on you. You know, you have to know that your call can be coming any time, and you have to be prepared and be ready, especially if you're one of the top guys. But he was in shape for that fight. Again, I thought that he was going to get exposed in that match. Eddie Alvarez, I thought, was going to expose him. Yeah. I was like, Eddie Alvarez has good grappling that's much better than his. Eddie Alvarez is super tough. Eddie Alvarez has taken on the best guys for a long time. He might be the greatest fighter ever to fight at 155 pounds, arguably. Yeah. He's in the conversation. And he got destroyed.
Yeah.
Destroyed, absolutely.
Well, it's not with McGregor, too, that, like, the Habib fight, the way that he just got, that McGregor got destroyed by Habib was something that was a little bit surprising to me, too. I thought it would have been a little bit more competitive.
I actually thought it was going to end quicker than it did. I actually thought he was more competitive than I thought he would be. But the thing is again, this is the Khabib is so specialized in one aspect of the fight world that what starts to happen is that you want to avoid that so much that you start doing things that you wouldn't normally do. So you start getting so paranoid about the takedown.
Yeah.
That when he does that change levels in the overhand right, that is a terrible looking strike, but he makes it work because he knows exactly what they're going to do. He goes, when I change levels, they're going to go to sprawl. They're going to go right into this fist.
Yep. And it worked.
Yeah, exactly. So again, it's he's so dominant from a grappling perspective that it changes the way people react to strikes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with everybody, I mean, like the thing about that fight was that you know that if Habib managed to, you know, get it onto the ground, keep it on the ground, then it was going to be a win for him. And then that was my take on it too. If McGregor can manage to keep it standing, you know, he's got a good chance of eventually getting that knockout from it. But, you know, it's just he wasn't able to keep it on the feet.
Yeah.
And when he was on the feet too, you're definitely right that he was just so paranoid about the takedown that he wasn't really doing his thing. Yeah.
It's the takedowns are dominant. So
yeah.
The only two guys that there's only two guys that I think have actually fought off Khabib's takedowns with any real success, and they were both guys that are high level grapplers themselves.
Yeah.
One was Gleison Tibau, or I think that's how you say his name, who's a guy who I don't think people realize how many UFC fights that guy had, but that guy was super hard to take down. He was massive for 155 pounds.
Yeah.
Absolutely huge. And then Abel Trujillo or something like that. I'm probably butchering his name. Who was another guy who was a high-level wrestler. But I think Khabib took him down like 20 times in that match. The thing is that the guy just had the ability to re-scramble back up to his feet.
Yeah.
I think, again, there's only a couple guys that I really think are bad matches. I think Tony Ferguson would be able to take him out, too. I think Tony Ferguson's a real bad matchup for McGregor.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
He's just so...
Tony Ferguson is actually really... Hey, he's just an interesting fighter. He's an oddball in terms of...
But he's a bad matchup for anybody.
Yeah, it's like the wild... There's like a wild card element to Tony Ferguson, that he does things that are just so weird and different than what anybody else does.
Yeah, you can speak better of his striking. His grappling is really good.
Yeah.
Really, really good. Yep. Really great wrestling, really good jiu-jitsu.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, but he was a high-level wrestler before that.
Yeah.
But he's got nasty darts chokes, which is a choke where you do with one arm in and then you catch the net. Yeah.
That's one
he can set them up from standing. He's got a really tricky guard, and from the bottom, he's very, very good at throwing elbow strikes from the bottom.
Yeah.
Really good. Really good at that. I mean, you could speak to his striking better than I can.
Sure. I mean, the standing thing, he just seemed like there's a certain predictability is something I would say as a fighter that people, I think, sometimes gets overlooked. And like that, it's what creates like the chess match. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That like when you're, and it's actually something that limits that a lot of martial arts, in my opinion, that like, you know, it's like karate guys getting really good at fighting other karate guys.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're both doing pretty much the same thing. It's yeah. very similar. So then it becomes that chess match of just, you know, like the timing and everything like that. And then you throw like Tony Ferguson in there that's just doing this like these like wild, like weird things. It throws you off. You don't know how to react to it. Like that. And it's something that, you know, of course, you know, you have to have a certain amount of ability to make that kind of stuff work.
Yeah.
But the advantage I'd say that I see that he seems to have when he fights is just like, how do you handle him? It's like, okay, you know how to handle, you know, a guy like a kickboxer, a guy with like a Muay Thai type
yeah.
striking skill set. You know how to handle, you know, a grappler's like wrestling and Brazilian jiu-jitsu like that. But how do you handle just this guy that, is going to do a bunch of weird, wild stuff that like...
Yeah, right? I mean, I think this is something that every martial artist can relate to, even in your own individual practice, not even if you're doing a cross-training thing, because it's like, if you grapple for years, you're like, okay, this person will try to do these things from the position you go with somebody who's unexperienced.
Yeah.
They're like, I just want to get out of this thing. And they do something where you're like, whoa, where did that come from?
Yeah, it's like something that shouldn't work,
yeah.
but does simply because it was the last thing you were expecting
them
to do. Yeah, that's what they say a lot of the time, that like the most dangerous, from a like striking karate perspective, the most dangerous people to spar often are like intermediate students, like people who have been training for like a year or two,
yeah.
maybe, but they're athletic, so yeah. they're like, you know, they're game, they're kind of like they have some natural ability, you know, like they're able to hit with some power and stuff, but the technique isn't really refined, so it's like weird, it just throws you off because they're doing weird stuff that you're not used to seeing. So that's I think something that all the fight, Tony Ferguson is the person I see that in more than anyone else, where it's just, it seems like it's just hard for people to react to the stuff that he does.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, is that I don't think people realize that McGregor has beaten pretty much most of the top guys.
Yeah.
From 145, 155. Mm-hmm. And he's really hasn't taken on a bunch of top guys in 170, but he does present some problems for some of these guys. Now,
definitely,
I don't think that it would end well if he took on Usman. I think Usman would just, I think he would just do a grappling clinic on him.
Yeah, I don't know if he'd take that fight.
Yeah, I mean, some part of me thinks that he would consider it, mm-hmm. just because I think that he likes this idea of having three different weight classes that he's dominated.
Yeah.
He sort of started the two division thing. He would be the first person to do three divisions.
Sure.
So I think he likes it, but I think in his ideal situation, I think that he has a plan that he's hoping that Masvidal takes out Usman and then he has a better chance taking out Masvidal.
Yeah, I can see that.
Which I actually don't think that's a great matchup for McGregor, but again, any time it's a striker with McGregor seems to have the edge.
Sure.
So I'm going to just, at this point, I stopped doubting McGregor a long time ago.
Yeah.
I was one of those guys that was always like, when he was coming up, being like, the next guy's going to be the guy.
Yeah.
He can't keep this up.
Yeah.
He's not that good.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was wrong.
Yeah.
I feel like everybody who was like a martial artist that I feel like that was watching him, for the most part, that was the thing.
Yeah.
It was like, he'll get exposed at some point.
Sure.
And that just never really happened.
Yeah.
He's going to go down as one of the greatest, like he's going to be in the conversation for the 10 greatest people to ever do
sure.
MMA once he retired.
He definitely changed the sport. You know, he had a bigger following than any other fighter prior to that, in terms of getting just like people watching, people paying attention to MMA.
Yeah,
but, I mean, yeah. So he's got that going for him. But I think there was a Dana White in an interview called, you know, McGregor the best to ever, you know, best MMA fighter ever. For that reason, they said you take everything into account. And what I interpret that as was the entertainment aspect as well, that you would, that he would consider him the best ever.
Like, the thing is that I feel like, so the person that was the sort of transcendent talent that was kind of the crossover star before him that helped usher in MMA to being really popular after a down period was Chuck Liddell.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then prior to Chuck Liddell, the original UFCs were popular just because it was, we can finally settle the question of whose martial arts the best.
Yeah, yeah.
And this like kind generation of like, one. Oh, we're going to see no hold bar fighting. So the original generation had that, but then it took a huge steep decline. It wasn't popular. Yeah. Chuck Liddell kind of ushered in the next era of popularity and crossover stars.
Yeah.
And then it kind of was like at a crossroads again. And then McGregor's the guy who took it to the next level. And what McGregor did, like the thing is, outside of fighting in there, he had his Whiskey's logo.
Yeah, yeah.
In the ring, that is unheard of.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I don't think anybody's ever done that in any combat sport.
Yeah.
And like I think like Floyd Mayweather did something sort of similar, where Floyd Mayweather is kind of like the first guy who started like maybe promoting his own fights.
Yeah.
I know there's other fighters that have transitioned into the role of promoter.
Sure.
Yeah. But I think Floyd Mayweather might be the first guy who promoted his own fights
while he was still fighting.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that that's McGregor's ultimate goal, and he said that before.
Yeah.
Is that to try and promote his own fights, which
well,
is,
he said he wants stock in the UFC.
I mean, he's on the verge of possibly being able to make that a reality with the way.
Isn't that kind of an interest? But like once again, talking about like a sports league.
Yeah, it's a conflict.
Like, yeah, it seems like a huge conflict of interest.
Who knows? Like, yeah. I don't know how it works because I don't know who like who's really regulating some of these things.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, who knows?
Well, Dana White, I think, already has said that he would like to push McGregor through. I think, bro, you know, he had said if he got the win over Cowboy that he would be a possibly get a title shot, which is one of those things that kind of crazy, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it is and it isn't, because they're going to give Yoel Romero a title shot, and Yoel Romero's lost his last two fights and has lost three of his last four.
Yeah.
Aldo's getting a title shot, and Aldo just lost his last fight. So, like, again, it comes back to the thing we talked about the past and what we talked about with the prize fighting.
Yeah.
Episode we did is it's an entertainment business first.
Sure.
Like the most deserving sometimes gets the shot, but it's only if it's the most deserving who also they can sell.
Make the most money.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't matter if you deserve the title shot, but they don't feel like they can sell you. They just don't care. They'll let you toil away, and then eventually you'll get a loss, and then when you get the loss, they're like, well, we would have maybe given you a title shot if you kept winning.
Yeah.
And that's what they're banking on.
So, predictions of where you think this is going to go. I think that we'll see. You think we're going to see the trilogy with Diaz?
I think that what's going to happen is I think they're going to sort of see what happens, I think, with Usman versus Masvidal. I think that's going to be the fight.
Yeah.
I think if Masvidal wins, I think he's going to go for the title at 170.
Yeah.
If Masvidal doesn't win, I think that we'd probably see the Nate Diaz trilogy. I don't think he goes straight for Khabib. I think he's going to do another match before that.
You think that he'll ever fight Khabib again?
I think it's a possibility. But, I mean, the thing is that everybody's overlooking Tony Ferguson.
That's true, yeah.
Like, what happens if Tony Ferguson wins,
yeah,
then does Conor McGregor even ever mention Khabib again?
Probably not. Yeah.
Because he'll If Tony Ferguson wins, he might go, I'll take on Tony Ferguson right now.
Yeah.
And then maybe he beats Tony Ferguson and he goes, I don't need to take on Khabib ever again. Who knows?
I can definitely see that.
I mean, at the same time, though, the thing that's the defining thing about Conor McGregor and the reason why he's so great is his ego. He uses it as his superpower.
Yeah.
So if maybe he gets the title shot, he just wants to prove to himself that he can beat Khabib. So he might have to match again for that reason.
Sure.
Like, yeah. He didn't need to do the Nate Diaz fight again. He chose to do it because he needed to do it for his own ego.
Sure.
He
well, that's why it seemed like he's pushing the trilogy with the two, which is interesting too. Because like again, when you look at records, it's like Nate Diaz's record is kind of again. He's a veteran. He's a guy who's been around forever. You know, he's sort of he's fought a lot of the best. He's beat a lot of guys who were really good, but he's also got a lot of losses.
Yeah.
But he's got that, Diaz brothers have that cult following, I think makes them, once again, there's profitable, you know, it's like, those are fights that sell.
Yeah.
I think that a trilogy fight with Diaz probably, I'm sure, would be a huge pay-per-view.
All right. Thanks for listening, guys. We appreciate it.
Keep training.